Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast hosted by Labor Relations Information System about recent developments in the public safety labor world. Now, my name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host over the course of the next 45 minutes or an hour or so. And let's get right into it. We've got some breaking news as I'm recording this podcast. I'm recording it on May the 3rd. Last night, the House of Representatives passed a bill that would expand comp time into the private sector. And I want to talk about this a little bit because there are some public safety implications to this whole issue about comp time and what it looks like if it does move into the private sector. And I have to give you some context on this. So let's start with way back when. And way back when, in our case, is 1938, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed by Congress. As the FLSA was first written, comp time was an illegal form of compensation for overtime. Congress had a couple of reasons for doing that, for insisting that all overtime be paid in cash. And remember, the FLSA is getting passed as part of a number of recovery passages during the latter years of the Great Depression. So Congress has its eyes firmly fixed, I think, on the economic conditions in the country at the time. So Congress's rationales, the two that I think are most important, were, first of all, it wanted to make working employees' long hours more expensive for employers, on the notion that if you forced employers to pay a premium, time and a half, employers would go out there and hire more employees at straight time rather than hire a bunch of employees who, and then force them to work time and a half. This is one of the core notions behind the FLSA, and that is of spreading overtime and employment opportunities around. Congress's second rationale in demanding cash payment of overtime, I think, was rooted in a bit of distrust of employers. Congress thought that if you allowed comp time as a substitute for cash compensation for overtime, employers would find some way basically to rig the system, to either force employees to take comp time against their will, force them to use it against their will, whatever. It would be a system that would be easily manipulable, that's a tough word to get out, by employers. And that's the way it stood for decades after 1938. Fast forward, though, to 1985. In 1985, the U.S. Supreme Court issues a decision known as Garcia versus San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority. This is the case in which the Supreme Court held that the FLSA could constitutionally be applied to cities and counties. Before that, the court had ruled that that violated what's known as the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Well, the court changed its mind, and in Garcia, by the narrowest of margins, a 5-4 margin, the court upheld the constitutionality of the FLSA. So all of a sudden, you've got this new set of rules, the FLSA, applying in the public sector where they never applied before. And so Congress, in November of 1985, ended up passing a number of public sector-specific amendments to the FLSA. And the intent behind them was to give employers some relief from the FLSA in areas where there had been practices that had grown up in the public sector over time by virtue of the FLSA not applying. And so we saw things like Section 7P of the FLSA get added to the law that allows volunteerism by public employees under some circumstances, or another subsection of Section 7P that allows ship trades that basically aren't allowed in the private sector. Well, one of these public sector specific amendments was Section 7O. And Section 7O, for the first time, allows comp time in lieu of cash compensation for overtime. Only for public sector employees. It still doesn't apply to the private sector. Only for public sector employees, and only under some very specific circumstances. There are really five separate elements of Section 7.0 that have to be met before it's legal to use. You have to have, for example, an agreement between the employer and the labor organization to use comp time. Comp time has to be a time and a half. There's no such thing as straight time comp time under the FLSA. Comp time can't be forfeited. There's no such thing as use it or lose it comp time under the FLSA. And when an employee terminates retirement or terminates before retirement, the employee has to be paid for all comp time on the books at the rate, whatever their regular rate of pay is, at the time that they retire or terminate service. So there's all these rules with respect to comp time for it to exist in the public sector. Well, the whole idea behind allowing comp time was pushed by employers back in 1985. This was, as I mentioned, a bill that was designed to give employers relief, public sector employers relief, from some of the more expensive provisions of all of a sudden applying the FLSA to the public sector. But immediately, private sector employers started casting an eye towards what was going on in the public sector. And we have seen an effort in Congress ever since to expand comp time into the private sector. It's been an effort that's always been led by the Republican Party. Democrats have never really been much interested in it. It's never really gone all that far. Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, was a big proponent of it, but even when he was Speaker, he couldn't get it through. It's one of those bills that you see these in Congress that every once in a while some senator or congressperson will make sure that a committee grants a hearing on the bill, but Congress just isn't serious about ever passing it. And then all of a sudden, this year, in movement that is at an amazing pace, particularly for the House of Representatives this year, Congress has considered and, not Congress, the House of Representatives has considered and has passed a bill that will expand comp time into the private sector. It's a bill that was approved last night, largely along party line votes. Republicans supported it. Democrats opposed it. It's a bill where the lobbying is very, very clear. Businesses are in favor of it. Unions are against it. And really, that same discussion that was had back in 1938 is the discussion that's being had today. Can an employer find some way to manipulate a comp time system? President Trump has now weighed in and has said he supports changing the law to allow comp time in the private sector. Who knows what the Senate is going to do? The Senate, as we've seen over the years, and particularly in the last 3 to 4 months, the Senate exists as an additional check in this whole process and moves much slower than you see from the House of Representatives. All right, so what are the public sector implications of all of this? Well, first of all, what passed the House of Representatives would allow employers in the private sector much more control over comp time than they have in the public sector. And if those private sector rules leak over into the public sector, which might be inevitable, you're going to end up seeing substantial changes in the comp time systems that we have in the public sector. But secondly, and this one may be a little bit more important, we have a huge unresolved issue about comp time in the public sector. And the issue is, who controls when comp time is used? Is it the employee's choice as to when to use comp time, or is it the employer's choice? And we have courts that are split right down the middle on that issue. Now, this is an issue that's been debated in the courts for, well over 15 years at this point in time. The first court to weigh in was the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals down in Texas in a case involving Houston, and the court ended up holding in that case that the employer controls when comp time is used, and that an employee has the right to make a request to use comp time on a particular day. So, for example, today, May 3rd, I could ask to use comp time on my birthday on October 15th. But the employer doesn't have to honor that request, so long as it gives me a day off reasonably proximate to the day that I want it. That's what the Fifth Circuit held. So instead of October 15th, if it gives me a day off, even though it's not my birthday, reasonably proximate to October 15th, there'd be no FLSA problem. So that sort of immediately raised the question of what does reasonably proximate mean, and we got our second Court of Appeals decision, this from the Ninth Circuit in a case involving Sacramento County. Ninth Circuit is on the western part of the United States. And the Ninth Circuit sided with the Fifth Circuit and said employers have control over the use of comp time. And what does a reasonably proximate use of comp time mean? The Ninth Circuit said within a year. So if I put in a request for comp time for October 15th and the employer says no, according to the Ninth Circuit, you can have March 3rd the following year off, even if you don't want March 3rd off, there's no FLSA violation. So those are the first two courts of appeals that weighed in on the issue. Then we have two more, and they are from the Sixth Circuit, thank Cleveland, the case involves Cleveland, and the Seventh Circuit, thank Chicago, the case involves the Chicago Police Department. And those two courts of appeals looked at the earlier decisions from the courts of appeals, the ones from the Fifth and Ninth Circuit, and said that's nonsense. The statute very clearly says that there's a procedure for the use of comp time, and the employee makes a request for a date, in my example, October 15th, and the employer must grant that date. Unless letting the employee off on that date would cause undue disruption. And what does undue disruption mean? The two courts, if you harmonize their two opinions, said, well, we know what it doesn't mean. You know what it doesn't mean? It doesn't mean that you have minimum staffing requirements that would require you to call somebody else in on an overtime basis to backfill for the employee who wants to use comp time. That's not a basis to just say no to a comp time request. You have to show that you can't do your basic mission, no matter what the cost is to you, employer, of doing your basic mission. Now, I know for those of you familiar with the Cleveland case in the Sixth Circuit, I know I'm gliding over a lot, and I apologize for that, but that's essentially, I think, how those cases are put together. So we have this almost untenable situation in the country right now because of this split among the federal courts of appeals, where the answer to the question, who controls when comp time is used, depends upon where you live in the country. If you're in the Fifth Circuit or the Ninth Circuit, it's the employer. If you're in the Sixth Circuit or the Seventh Circuit, it's the employee. Which has the better rationale? Well, in my judgment, you know, even if I take my day job hat off, my day job of representing unions, even if I take that hat off, I've got to say I think the Sixth and Seventh Circuit are reading the statute more correctly, and I would expect if the dispute continues to come up in the public sector, I would expect that we're going to see the result that employees control comp time use. But we do have this split. How can the House of Representatives or Congress now be thinking of expanding the use of comp time into the private sector without having an answer to that basic question? And the legislation so far has no answer to that basic question. This is one you definitely want to stay tuned about. It may well be that we're going to see developments very quickly as this bill moves over into the Senate. Hard to tell. It may well be that this is something that goes over into the Senate and we could look up in 2019 and there's still not been a hearing granted on this bill. Tough to say. I can just say for certain the speed with which this made it through the House of Representatives almost without any meaningful debate is very impressive. Next up, I want to talk about a major firefighter staffing case that comes out of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. First of all, we don't get negotiability decisions from state Supreme Courts very often at all. Usually these are decisions, what's negotiable, what's mandatory for bargaining, what's a negotiable wage hour or working condition. Usually those sorts of questions are asked and answered in labor boards. Occasionally they'll come out in the form of an arbitrator's opinion. Sometimes you'll see them from a court of appeals, but shoot, we don't see more than half dozen of these decisions issued by state Supreme Courts, all 50 of them put together. Over the course of a year, it's pretty unusual to see one, and we don't see them on staffing very often. This is a firefighter staffing case, and I introduce it very specifically using the words firefighter because the courts up until this point have drawn a pretty clear line as to whether staffing is negotiable for firefighters versus whether it's negotiable for law enforcement officers. And typically the rulings have been that staffing for law enforcement officers is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. The employer doesn't have to negotiate over staffing levels. But the decisions are more mixed over on the fire side. And we see a lot of decisions in the past from various places across the country that the number of firefighters per rig, per piece of equipment, is mandatory for bargaining. More mixed decisions on whether the number of firefighters per shift or number of firefighters per population is negotiable. So there's a landscape that's been carved out there in various places around the country that suggests that under some circumstances, some form of firefighter staffing is mandatory for bargaining. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in this case involving the city of Allentown, Pennsylvania, really does a very thorough job of examining this issue of staffing and I think makes some sweeping pronouncements. So let me set the table for you a little bit here. As I mentioned, this involves the city of Allentown, and it has a collective bargaining agreement with Local 302 of the International Association of Firefighters. This is a contract that was left to expire for a number of years, and the staffing clause that was in the contract actually was implemented over the course of 2005 to 2007. So what the contract said was that for 2005, there was a minimum on-duty shift strength of 26 firefighters. That would move up a notch to 27 firefighters in 2006 and 28 firefighters in 2007. So the parties by 2011 are still in bargaining over a successor contract. They can't reach an agreement. The city declares an impasse and requests binding arbitration on the contract. And in Pennsylvania, you have typically a three-person arbitration panel with a neutral arbitrator with what are known as partisan wings, management wing and a labor wing. And this panel was considering things like wages, sick leave, vacation, pension, overtime, and staffing. And with regard to staffing, the panel held that the minimum number of firefighters per shift would drop from 28 to 25 firefighters. The city, though, wasn't satisfied and challenges the panel's opinion through the court system, saying nothing to do with firefighter staffing, or at least firefighter staffing per shift, is mandatory for bargaining. And this is the issue that goes up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, is under what circumstances, if any, is firefighter staffing mandatory for bargaining? And I think the court does an excellent job of setting up the discussion by talking about a couple of different concepts. And the two concepts that the court talks about are, on one hand, management responsibilities, management prerogatives. Think of these as sort of the entrepreneurial decisions that are vested with an employer that are not subject to the bargaining process. That's one set of topics, says the court. The other set of topics are those that are terms and conditions of employment, benefits. Those are negotiable. And the problem, the court says, is that there's not a fine line between these two. And I love the court's metaphor here. And let me read it to you, because I think it really helps fix in our minds this whole notion of what's mandatory for bargaining and what's not, and how difficult that decision can be sometimes. The court says, one may envision a Venn diagram with topics in the overlapping space that are terms and conditions of employment, which are subject to collective bargaining, that also implicate matters of managerial responsibility over which negotiation isn't mandated and can't be the basis of an arbitration award. So on one side, the court is saying, you've got this circle, typical Venn diagram circle, of negotiable topics. On the other side, you have management rights, but there's this area in between where clearly a subject fits into both categories. And when something does fit into both categories, we're going to look at the evidence. And we're going to look at which side marshaled the most evidence that, from a union standpoint, a working condition should be negotiable, or from management standpoint, that this really is a core management decision. And here, the court says, the union wins. There's overwhelming evidence, the court said, based in the arbitration hearing, that there is a relationship between shift staffing and time. The amount of firefighters that you have on shift will influence what your response time is to a fire. Why does that matter? That relates in turn to the temperature of a fire, which has an impact on firefighters' safety. There are numerous studies that are out there, the court said, that the IAFF put into evidence in this arbitration, that link increased staffing to a decrease in on-the-job injuries and lower workers' compensation claims. And there are other studies showing a link between staffing and physical and emotional stress. There's even evidence, the court said, that it's the number of employees per shift that is important, maybe even under some circumstances, more important than the number of employees per apparatus. So on one hand, the court says the union did a very good job of building a record on this case. What about the employer side? And here the court is very critical. The court said the city's evidence about shift staffing was much more limited and focused primarily on the overtime costs of having minimum staffing, and in particular, how those overtime costs were causing pensions to spike. And while the court said, look, you know, that is a legitimate issue, but it was thoroughly disputed by the union, and we think, the court says, on the end, that shift staffing mandates are mandatory for bargaining. shifts, so number of firefighters per shift. Here's the tagline from the court. While we are acutely aware of and sensitive to the significant financial challenges facing the city and other cities in our state, we conclude that the city hasn't demonstrated that a minimum staffing requirement unduly infringes on its managerial responsibilities. And I think there's a lesson in this whole case. Sometimes we see parties to the unfair labor practice process, and that's how this whole thing really started, was with something akin to an unfair labor practice. Sometimes we see parties not treating those as serious litigation. We see them bring in a witness or two and not really putting on the sort of case you would put on if you were in court. That seems to be the way the city approached the interest arbitration hearing in this situation. Put on kind of a half-hearted finances argument. And on the other hand, we saw the IAFF put on a very strong safety-related argument. So the kind of the lesson that I would take from all this is, if you've got an issue that's big enough, you better be pulling out all the stops in litigating whether or not this topic is mandatory per bargain. Now, this is just a decision from Pennsylvania. Doesn't automatically apply to other states, although I do think there's a fair amount of persuasive value in this opinion. I know, for example, that there's a California staffing case, the firefighter staffing case, that is coming up quickly. I'll probably refer to it in next month's podcast. So stay tuned on this one as well. As we are seeing, public sector budgets still relatively constrained. As we are seeing that, we are seeing a lot more litigation over the issue of staffing. Okay, a brief interlude for you. I wanted to point out that we're doing a first ever seminar for us in August, and you can find the information on this seminar on our webpage at LRIS.com. It's a seminar on communications for law enforcement and fire protection unions. And just a word or two about this seminar. This is kind of born out of the notion that I've had for, well, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years now, that public safety unions aren't doing the best job they can at communicating with their three core constituencies. And those constituencies are the public, their membership, and politicians, elected officials, opinion leaders in a community, that group of individuals. And that sometimes we see public safety unions thoroughly losing the battle on communications, whether it be firefighters with the closure of fire stations or consolidation of departments into fire districts, or whether it be law enforcement unions trying to deal with the latest deadly force incident that has found its way onto YouTube within 13 minutes after the incident has been concluded. It's just been my belief that unions don't have a good enough feel for the idea that communications has to be part and parcel of what it is they do, and it has to be right up there with bargaining, and sometimes maybe even as important or more important than bargaining, because your ability to communicate dictates, to some extent, your rate of success in bargaining. So we put together a seminar, 2.5-day seminar. It's going to have everything from communications 101, you know, how do you do a press release, how do you give a press conference, what about social media, what are the different social media platforms, what's their penetration into the public, how are unions effectively using social media, how are they not so effectively using social media. Our second day is going to start, and this one's kind of poignant for me right now because I'm actually recording this up in Anchorage, where I represent the Police Association in Anchorage. The second day, we're going to focus on a couple of major attacks on collective bargaining rights. One occurred in Anchorage through the passage of a local ordinance that would have caused a 34% reduction in the wages and benefits for Anchorage firefighters and police officers. The other was the statewide effort in Ohio a number of years ago, known as Senate Bill 5, after Governor John Kasich was elected, that would have fundamentally eliminated meaningful collective bargaining in Ohio. And so we're going to talk about how it is the unions in those two instances were able to successfully take on the challenge of defeating those measures. The second day of the seminar, we're also going to have 3 hours on critical incident communication, the things to say and not say. And then we'll wind up the seminar on the third day with what I think of as a particular success story in communications, and that is the firefighters union in the city of Los Angeles, where a new board fundamentally re-energized and changed that organization. I don't usually talk much about seminars in this podcast, but I'm really excited about this one. We have some great speakers from all over the country, and I do think that this is a very, very important topic, and hope you can join us there. Now I want to talk about an arbitration opinion that illustrates a point that I don't understand why we still need to have arbitration decisions and court decisions holding this, but we apparently do. And the question is this: can somebody who is a fact witness also be responsible for the disciplinary investigation into an incident? This is an arbitration opinion that comes out of Oakland, California. And it involves two separate incidents with the same officer. So let me talk to you about those two separate incidents and then talk about what happened in the arbitration process. So one day on patrol, a couple of Oakland police officers saw what they thought to be a drug transaction as they're driving by. I know, shock, right? But they saw it. They stopped one of the suspects, and that gave the officers cause to detain the suspect and led to the recovery of cash and illegal drugs in the vicinity of the suspect. While the suspect is being detained, he starts claiming that he's ill. I know that's a shock, too. And the officers summon medical support on his behalf. And then the suspect makes a general statement that's heard by the officers. And some of these are pretty direct terms, but I'm guessing you guys can all take it. He makes a general statement that he's going to, quote, shit myself. And one of the officers responds, you can shit all over yourself, you can do what you want, but you're going to jail. A sergeant arrives at the scene. The suspect complains that the officers treat him with disrespect, that they looked at him like he was a sideshow freak, a liar, and stupid. The sergeant gives the suspect a complaint packet and documents the complaint through a memorandum, and an IA investigation results. Okay, that's incident one. Incident two. While the IA investigation is ongoing, one of those two officers responds to a report of the shooting, the officer who had made the comment. The officer detained two suspects while other officers are searching on foot for additional suspects. While lying on the ground, one of the two suspects made what the officer thought was a furtive move and caused the officer to warn the suspect, and I'm going to quote here, "Don't move or my partner will shoot you in the head." That, of course, produces another internal affairs complaint. And eventually, the department sustains charges from both of these incidents and imposes a 3-day suspension. And that's the issue that goes to arbitration. The union, the Oakland Police Officers Association, is challenging the sustaining of both of these charges. The arbitrator takes them apart. The arbitrator says, look, with respect to the first of these charges, you've got a really big problem here, because that sergeant who handed the suspect the complaint packet, that sergeant who talked to the suspect about what occurred, that sergeant who wrote a memorandum that documented what the suspect had to say, He later got transferred to Internal Affairs, and he was in charge of the investigation into the officer. The sergeant, when he was in Internal Affairs, even signed a form saying, "I am not directly involved in the incident, and I don't have any relationship with any of the individual parties that could be perceived as compromising the investigative process." And the arbitrator says, "What? How could you sign that? How could you be in charge of that investigation? You were a fact witness. You were out at the scene. You listened to the suspect." Let me read to you what the arbitrator says, because I think these words are pretty important. And I'm quoting, "An objective investigation is one where the employer makes an affirmative good faith effort to establish the alleged misconduct and provide the employee with an opportunity to explain the reasons behind his or her actions. The concept of just cause depends upon an objective investigative process in which a witness cannot also be an investigator." The arbitrator says the sergeant's supervision of the investigation in IA disqualifies the investigation as one that is fair and impartial. And therefore, the arbitrator sustains that part of the grievance, says no discipline on this, because you didn't do an impartial investigation. What about the second one? My partner's going to shoot you in the head comment. The arbitrator says, "Hey, that one's not infected. You didn't have someone who was a fact witness do the investigation or be responsible for the investigation. And you know what? The officer said it, and it does violate the department's rules. So what's the remedy?" The arbitrator says, "Look, since you gave him the 3-day suspension for the combination of these two incidents, and I've said you can't discipline on one of them, I'm sending the case back to you to determine what the appropriate sanction should be based upon the disciplinary matrix that's in effect in your department." And who knows what that is going to be. You know, this seems like a small case, right? A 3-day suspension, and it's an arbitrator's decision, so it's not really binding on anybody who's not in Oakland. Seems like a small issue. But I can't tell you how many times I see cases where someone who is a fact witness also does the investigation. And I see this a lot in the fire service, where there aren't really rigid lines between, you know, who's doing an internal affairs investigation versus a line investigation. And you just see a lot of confusion over that. In law enforcement, you see this kind of all the time in what I think of as precinct-level investigations. I can remember several cases. In fact, I know of one going on right now where the disciplinary investigation is into whether an officer should have called off a pursuit. Guess who's doing the investigation? The sergeant who was on duty at the time the pursuit happened. The sergeant who had the ability to call off the pursuit if the sergeant wanted to do so. The sergeant who was participating in the pursuit behind the officer who was the lead officer in the pursuit. Where's that thing going to go? It's going to go nowhere fast, because you simply can't have a fact witness also be an impartial investigator. While I'm talking disciplinary decisions and arbitration, I want to move over to Minnesota for a moment. This is not a published arbitrator's decision. It was sent to me by one of the attorneys representing the parties. And I thank anybody, by the way, who sends us in arbitration decisions. We're just junkies for these sorts of things. The more you can send, the better. Electronically, please, if you're going to do it. It would be great. And this is a case that involves another question you see come up from time to time. It's a police case, but it could be a fire case. And the question is, to what degree does newspaper publicity about an incident form the basis for discipline that is issued? So let me tell you about this this case. We don't know the officer's name in this case. You may or may not know this, but when you get arbitration opinions, quite frequently, arbitrators will anonymize the names of individuals who are involved in a disciplinary case. And it's just a long tradition. You wouldn't see it in court, but it's a long tradition that exists in arbitration. So this is a case that comes out of Montgomery, Minnesota, which is a small town in Minnesota. And the officers in Montgomery are represented by Law Enforcement Labor Services, Local 87 of Law Enforcement Labor Services, which is a statewide police union in Minnesota. And there were several disciplinary charges that resulted in a 21-day suspension for an officer. And these charges stemmed out of a complicated and disruptive family gathering involving the officer. And this is one that was attended by the officer, his wife, and their children. Everybody's kind of sitting around. The officer has a younger brother who's an adult with a cognitive disability. He gets mad because the officer's wife wouldn't let him hold her 8-month-old child. The brother tells the officer that his wife is a, quote, fucking bitch, and throws a cell phone at her, and it breaks on the ground. And after that, the family gathering generally disperses. But that sort of sets the stage for what's going to happen later in the evening. And later in the evening, the officer, his older brother, not the younger one with the cognitive disability, his older brother, who's also a city council member, as I mentioned, this is a small town, and a female cousin spend the evening drinking beer around a bonfire. And by the way, I can assure you, after more than 35 years of doing this work, any arbitration opinion involving the phrase drinking beer around a bonfire is going to involve a fascinating result. And at any rate, this one does as well. So shortly after midnight, the two brothers are arguing about what happens if the city disbands the police department. And the brother who's on the city council is saying, I'm thinking maybe we're going to do that. And there's a apparently very animated discussion about, well, then how are citizens going to be protected? This animated discussion turns into a physical altercation, and the officer eventually uses his wrestling skills. This is the way the arbitrator puts it. To subdue his brother, and then he goes home. He's only a couple blocks away from his own house. He walks the couple blocks. The officer's brother calls 911 and requests police assistance to remove an unwanted person, his phrasing, from his property. And the brother reports that when he asked the officer to leave, the officer said, "Why don't you make me?" And then the scuffle resulted, and the officer, says the brother, put the brother into a headlock. The brother says he wants to file criminal charges, and in fact, 2 months later, the officer is criminally charged with, get ready for the overkill here, felony domestic assault by strangulation, as well as 2 misdemeanor assault charges. Those all get resolved pursuant to a plea agreement where the officer pleads guilty to a misdemeanor of disorderly conduct. And there's a pretty skimpy factual basis for the disorderly conduct plea. The statement in court that eventually is read is that the officer refused a request to immediately remove himself from the property, and he swore at and used profane language towards the property owner. So the city then swings into action in a disciplinary sense and suspends the officer for 21 days. And in part, the city's disciplinary decision is based on the negative publicity that comes from the local newspaper about the filing of the charges. And the city argues in arbitration that the front page of the local newspaper reported the domestic assault charges, and stated that the officer had betrayed his badge, integrity, and character, as well as the public trust. So that's the issue that goes to arbitration, the 21-day suspension. So the arbitrator looks at it and says, okay, first of all, I'm going to figure out whether or not the officer actually did anything terribly wrong out at his brother's house. And when I look at it, to me, it's very much a he said, she said sort of situation. Do I believe the officer or do I believe the brother? And the arbitrator says, I believe the officer. The brother's story changed over time. Brother eventually disavowed his assault claims, talked about the fact that he had anger management problems and documented medical conditions, and he's been taking medications for 10 years, and he ends up saying, I do not feel comfortable standing behind my statements that I gave in reference to the disturbance in my home. So the arbitrator says, look, when you look at all this, I don't see any basis to sustain those charges on the facts of what occurred out at the incident that night. So that leaves me with the city's argument about the publicity. And the arbitrator then stops being sort of the neutral, calm individual who disposes of a case and gets pretty harshly critical. And listen to these couple of sentences, three sentences, that the arbitrator writes. The union persuasively argues that the newspaper report was based on the inflated charges and subsequently discredited allegations by the brother. It is unfortunate that a community newspaper would so irresponsibly judge an accused before due process has run its course. Given the ultimate outcome of the matter and the accurate underlying facts, the officer cannot be held responsible for the newspaper's conduct and resulting public criticism. So the arbitrator ends up reversing the 21-day suspension. The arbitrator does find that the officer probably didn't act the way he should have acted, but it's pretty clear from the arbitrator's opinion that the arbitrator thinks the officer has been punished enough. So, lesson we learned from this, publicity may in fact matter in an arbitration hearing if the publicity is accurate and if an employer is able to demonstrate harm from the publicity. And both of those predicates were absent here. Publicity turned out not to be accurate, and the employer was unable to very convincingly demonstrate harm. By the way, if we're ever talking about opinions, whether they're court opinions or arbitrator opinions or whatever, and you can't find them online, just get in touch with us. We'll email them to you, assuming we have the authority to release them. Sometimes when people send us opinions, they don't allow us to release them publicly. They like to keep control of them, but if we can, we will get them off to you. Well, that about wraps it up. I've hit my magical moment of about 50 minutes for this podcast. I try to keep these as listenable as I possibly can. We're going to have a fascinating month coming up. I've already got two or three court decisions that are backlogged that I want to talk to you about next month. Certainly what is going on in Washington, D.C. right now with the healthcare law and things like comp time, things that may not even be on our radar right now. It may even warrant us doing a podcast mid-month to bring you up to speed on things. With that, we hope you check us out at LRIS.com. Take a look at our monthly newsletter, Public Safety Labor News, and perhaps consider coming to one of our seminars, particularly that communications seminar in August. Have a good month, and this is Will Aitchison signing off.